She turned up in the interview. She walked into the room and she had a goldfish bowl and a goldfish in the middle of it and went, Lee, I understand from people that you have the attention of a goldfish. And that was it. I was hooked.
That's incredible.
She said, I know I've only got 5 minutes of your time. And I couldn't believe somebody had brought a goldfish in.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning with your host, Oz Rashid. I am obsessed with how the best leaders identify top talent, and that's what we talk about here on the Higher Learning Podcast. New episodes come out every Wednesday on Spotify and Apple Music, so please download there. We got another great episode today. Today, we are joined by Lee Bushell. Lee is the founder and CEO of Bushell Investment Group. Lee, how the heck are you doing, man?
I'm good, Oz. How are you?
Good. I mean, we gotta talk about the elephant in the room right off the bat. You've got two big tusks in your office. Tell me the story behind that.
So I live in what's known as a British stately home. The house was built in 1755.
Oh, Lord.
So just before your country became independent, I'm guessing.
Sure.
And the tusks, albeit I don't really condone, in fact, I don't condone at all that type of behavior anymore. They are part of the history here. So the last guy that lived here, who died in 1948, a guy called Michael Swinfen Brown, he left the house to the local area, which is Lichfield, to the council, left 1,000 acres in this big old house, and he left these tusks here. And there is a sign on there, which unfortunately you can't see, but it's Baharay El Zerai, 1906, Michael Swinfen Brown, which I believe is now in South Sudan. Sudan.
Wow.
You have to check that up. So
PETA, you heard him. We don't condone this. It came with the house. Okay. We don't want any issues for myself and Lee. I'm just amazed at the history of the UK and of England. Just, you very like gallantly say 1700s, the house was built in. I mean, like you said, our country didn't even exist at that point. So truly amazing. I can't wait to come out there at some point and get a tour.
With pleasure. With absolute pleasure.
I love it. All right. So Lee, you are the founder of Bushell Investments. Talk to me. Tell me what your firm does and what you invest in and who you invest in.
Okay, so our firm is the unsexiest firm in the UK. So we look for investments in non-sexy businesses, the type of businesses that PE won't touch because they're just a bit too small for PE houses, and the type of investments that really... really smart young guys, Silicon Valley type guys, don't want to go anywhere near. And we fit firmly in that, I know in America, we buy uglyhouses.com. We buy ugly businesses. And when I say ugly businesses, I mean traditional either manufacturing or services businesses that just don't attract the attention that other businesses do. And that's how we're able to survive and thrive.
I love that. It's like an inefficiency in the market. Like you're looking at businesses that I assume have great cash situations or produce cash and are good businesses, but not the type of ones that your typical investor is going to go highlight on their LinkedIn or write about in magazine articles. These are just good businesses that you go and find and help take to another level. Do you go talk to these founders? Is that your pitch? Like, hey, I know this is an unsexy business, but I'm interested. Like, what's your pitch sound like when you?
Yeah. So Often it'll be one of two things, either a distressed business that needs some cash flow and then we change management or add into the management and turn it round, or it's typically retirement sales. So I read a book a few years back, actually, What They Teach You at Harvard Business School. It's obviously an American book. And they were talking about very similar things in that book as well. I forget who wrote it. But we will go into these founders and we'll say, listen, are you looking at selling? Have you thought about selling? And so on and so forth. And a lot of the times, these companies aren't in the, they're not big enough where, investment houses will deal with them or PE houses will be that interested. So a lot of the time, they don't have really good people around them to be able to get their businesses ready for a sale. And often, very often, these businesses have no succession planning. So the kids are, have either gone into the city to become, lawyers or accountants or whatever it may be. And they don't really want to run that family business anymore. And so we come in there, we give them a nice exit, and we leave them to work work down their time with us generally, although it can depend on deal to deal. Sometimes they leave straight away. Sometimes they just want to work 3 days a week, still keep themselves busy, but they don't want the hassle of running it anymore. And they just want to slowly, you know, go down into retirement. Because I think if you retire straight away, especially if you've been doing something 30, 40 years, it's very, very hard.
So, sure.
Often overlooked.
I know you said that this is an unsexy area, but for whatever reason, I've been reading a lot more about this over the last year. I feel like there's been a lot of people looking for investment opportunities because, you know, the baby boomer generation that we have here in the United States are aging and aging out. And many of them are the ones that have started some of these landscaping or plumbing or some of these different businesses, right? And an opportunity, they don't have necessarily a succession plan, or they don't even know what to do next. It's almost like the business dies along with, you know, their retirement or whenever they're done working. And so finding these opportunities of these kind of, you know, inefficiencies in terms of the types of businesses that aren't getting a lot of attention or maybe not looking at from other investors sounds like a great opportunity to get involved with it. I'm interested because you mentioned that you've been doing this since you were 15. Were you like, you know, as a youngster, like an entrepreneur, were you selling candy on the block? Were you like, has this always been part of your blood?
Yeah. So I set up my first company when I was 15 and I was still at high school. We were selling Calvin Klein tops out of my older brother's car. So we started with that. You know, I was at a really good independent school. So that was like, you guys would call it a private school.
Sure.
And so there weren't that many entrepreneurial wheeler dealers. You know, everybody was quite book smart, that type of thing.
Sure.
And so I was just there flogging them all of this clothing. And then very quickly we moved into a nightclub promotion.
Wow.
So it was, you know, in the UK, you can drink when you're 18, right? It's very different to the US.
Sure.
You can drink when you're 18, but, you know, when you're 15, you can look 18 with the right identification. So, you know, we'd have like 1,000 school kids from all around. I live in Birmingham, which is the second biggest city.
Sure.
Probably your equivalent of LA, but it definitely ain't LA. it's more like Detroit. And we'd have like 1,000 high school kids coming in, you know, all paying me £5 to get in. And I did that with some business partners who were slightly older than me. Wheeling, dealing, whatever I could, you know, even before I was 15, I was earning a bit of money.
Listen, I respect the hustle. When I was in junior high, I used to go buy these candy bars and these like blow pops, these little lollipops, and you'd buy them at Costco in bulk. And then you would go sell them for a quarter or a dollar at the time. Then I started selling Pogs, which were this stupid little game before Pokemon where people were like trading them, like trading cards and playing with them. I got involved with all different types of things. So like I can totally understand what it must have been like to be hanging out with Lee back in high school. And you got to have your fit. You got to have your drip back in, even at the private school. So the kids needed the CK, come to Lee's trunk, you get hooked up, and then maybe he'll invite you to the nightclub afterwards. I absolutely love it, man. Let's go back to the – go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's my brother's trunk, not my trunk.
Oh, listen, we got to make sure we give credit, okay? It's your brother's trunk.
I wasn't old enough. Which actually leads me on to something quite interesting, which is, you know, when I started off in business, my dad's old school, and he'd say things like, oh, don't tell anybody that business idea, or, you know, you mustn't mention that. And I think a lot of people are like really hepped up on it. They think they've got an idea that's going to change the world, right? And the reality is most of us don't. Most entrepreneurs are just doing something different or slightly better than somebody else is doing. You know, we're not, I'd use the example of James Dyson. You know, we're not James Dysons. You're probably not an Elon Musk. You know, those people are few and far between. And for the rest of us mere mortals, you know, what do we do? So we do something slightly different, but it's essentially the same. We're just doing it slightly better. And for me, going back to the point about the old man telling people not to do anything, I would say, well, no, share that with other entrepreneurs, because it's very rare you get to a situation where somebody's like, oh, I like that idea, I'm going to nick it. And then they're able to do that. You know, it takes conversations. It takes collaboration. It takes time.
That's actually one of my biggest learnings of being an entrepreneur. I remember, especially with the software, I was so, and still to a degree, somewhat private about it. But like, I was always like, oh my God, I don't want to share my ideas. What if somebody steals it? You know, you watch the movie like Social Network, or you watch all these different movies where people like, you know, take an idea and run with it and they become billionaires. And you're like, oh my God, I live a life of regret. But actually, that is such a fallacy. Ideas are a dime a dozen. Everyone's got them. the key, the money, the business is in the execution. And that's something I learned, right? I learned really quickly, like, yeah, you know what? It's funny because I have this an in-law, and when we would get together as boys, we would be talking about all these businesses and investment ideas. And one of the things that they were like, oh, don't share anything. I'm like, you know what? It doesn't matter if we go post this on the most public forum ever. The reality is the money is to be made in the execution. It's not in the ideas. Everybody's got ideas. And even if you have a very unique idea, taking it to market is 95% of the work. As they said in the movie, if you would have invented Facebook, you would have invented Facebook. And it is totally the truth. A key is in execution. It's not in the idea. So I totally agree with that. Now, I'm sure you got some other tendencies from your dad that have helped you throughout in your career, though, in terms of, you know, maybe grit and different things that you've done that have developed in you as a professional. Anything, any parallels you can draw there?
I mean, just the hard work ethic, you know, and also as well, my parents were really good because they weren't afraid to talk about money, you know, and I see quite a few friends and, you know, their parents never talked about money, never talked about business. It was always private, you know, never discuss it. Whereas at our kitchen table, it was always discussed. And it is even nowadays between me and my brothers and my parents. You know, money shouldn't be a taboo subject. Business shouldn't be a taboo subject. Work shouldn't be a taboo subject.
It's even more so in British culture, I feel like, too, because there's like a certain politeness or class, right? We don't talk about these different types of things. But I totally agree with you. I actually like have been thinking about like the generation I grew up in. And I feel really good about the fact that I grew up with like this old school work ethic, you know, these different types of things that I think were more like the 1960s and 50s and 70s type ethic. But now looking at the technology and the innovation and the gumption and the desire to take these big swings, I'd like to think I have both of those things, which I think are really, really important. Because more and more as I look at, you know, future generations, I look at my kids, it seems to be a little bit more skewed towards that latter part, where I think that that work ethic and that grit and that ability to kind of suffer through adversity and pain, I think that still does a lot for us as people, as professionals in our character, right?
100%. So I wrote an article about 5 years ago. I just posted it on LinkedIn, actually. If you get a chance, you should look at it. It's called The Angry Businessman Raising Money. And it basically is me just going on about these people who these kids nowadays who they call themselves entrepreneurs, but they're not entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs take risks, right? And all they do is raise money. So they don't actually have a business model. They've just got a little idea and they're really good at raising money. And all they ever do is raise money from one round to another round to another round. And they all lose focus on what is important in a business. And I don't care what anybody says, the most important thing in a business, besides cash flow, obviously, is profit, okay? It's wonderful to do all these social things and these enterprises and this ESG and give money to charity and all of these things. And I think that is really important. But don't forget, if you're not making money in the first place, you can never go and do those wonderful things, right? And people are, what has happened, especially with the tech world, Silicon Valley and valuations based off, I don't know, what might happen one day or what's sexy or whatever. It should be all based on the bottom line. That's simple mathematics for me. Now,
there's two different things that you said that really stand out to me. I was just talking about this with a founder earlier today at lunch. And I never wanted to be an entrepreneur that looked at raising capital as the goal, right? Like I see so many of these different people saying, oh, we just got this $10 million round and this 20. And listen, that is a humongous accomplishment, something that I hope to be going through over the next 12 to 18 months. And I'll probably celebrate it too. But that's not the point. The point is taking that capital to build a business of substance that matters. That the other thing I think about is this quote from Simon Sinek, where he said, and he's not usually known as like kind of a, you know, the hard-edged, you know, businessman, but he said that having a business is like having a car, okay? And money is the fuel, right? You can't do anything with that car without the fuel, right? At the end of the day. But it's also not the point of the business, which is to make an impact and to broaden things. And so I think about that a lot is that, hey, listen, it's great to do all these important things and be very holistic about it. But at the end of the day, you're not going to be around if you don't build a sustainable business, a business that makes profits, right? You can talk about having the greatest culture in the world, but if your company's not making money and you got to lay people off, I don't care how hunky-dory it feels in there and how much everybody loves each other, you're not going to have a great company. You're not going to have a great culture. You're not going to have a great business. So combining these holistic things with the fact that you need to be a business that's growing and people are part of something bigger than themselves is wholly important. I couldn't agree with you more on that.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire. the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
You've been involved with these different businesses. You have your investment group. You've been around people like Chris Ball and Hoxton Capital that have grown. So you've seen a lot about identifying great talent, and that's really what I'm excited and interested in. So I want to start here. When you're bringing somebody into your team, your organization, into your world, do you have a core hiring philosophy, or is there like a certain mantra you have in your head for people that you want to work with professionally?
No, it's done off gut. And when I meet them in the first 2 or 3 minutes and I shake their hand, and if they've got a firm handshake and they look me in the eye and they're able to hold a conversation with me, they're already 50% of the way there.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So you're going completely off gut. Now, listen, I believe that gut is something that is systematized and codified. Is it just their presence? Is it something specific you're looking for in what they talk about, who they talk about, how you know them, like anything that comes from that?
I think it depends on the role they're looking for, right? So if it's one of the more junior roles, we're going to be less disconcerting. There's a spark people have got, and it's whether you think, you know, if they start asking questions about, if they start asking questions and they lead with what's in it for them, as opposed to asking about the business, or people that haven't done any homework on the business, there's a few red flags then. You know, number one, they should have done their homework on our business. You know, yep. I like people to be able to lead the conversation. If you're asking a question, if somebody just gives a one-word answer or just gives a specific answer to that question generally, that's not really what I want to see in a person. I want somebody to take the conversation on and go on from there.
Yeah. Good call. I think that research is so important, and somebody that's putting in the time and the effort and they have the ability to communicate and articulate yourself, super, super important. What about, like, do you have any type of, like, you know, whether it be one of the businesses you invested in or anybody you brought onto your team, do you have like a memorable interview experience of something that was either crazy or really good, something that stands out to you when I ask you that?
So there is one. So we own a load of Supercuts franchises, the hairdressers. I know they're big in America, the biggest hairdressing firm in the world. So we have the UK franchise for them. So we have about 100 franchises. And our current CEO of that, who previously was the Bushell Investment Group marketing director, she came in for an interview. And she'd done her homework on me, realized that I had a very small attention span. And it was like her third interview, because I don't normally go to the interviews. And she turned up in the interview. She walked into the room and she had a goldfish bowl and a goldfish in the middle of it and went, "Lee, I understand from people that you have the attention of a goldfish." And that was it. I was hooked.
That's, you know, incredible.
She said, "I know I've only got 5 minutes of your time." And I couldn't believe somebody brought a goldfish in, because
it was. You still have that goldfish? Is it sitting on your desk next to the
shop? No, she never gave it to me. She took it home.
Well, see, you should have left it with you. Oh, I like that. That's really good. So that's going to be probably the most memorable interview you've had. What about, you talked about the gut, and sometimes the gut can betray us in these situations. Do you have a time where you thought you had a mark on somebody that was good and you brought them in and then you found out it wasn't what you thought? What happened there? Any kind of idea there when you miss on somebody? Why is it you miss?
Sometimes I have been guilty of getting confused with overconfidence in somebody and thinking that means they're going to be good at the job. You know, a lot of people aren't that confident. And sometimes you get a real, you know, what you think is a world beater into the room and they'll be taking the conversation away and you'll be like, "Wow, this guy's good. But then, so you employ them based on the interview, but then you realize that actually they are all mouth. So it's times like that when my gut has failed me. you don't get it right. You know, the older you get and the more people you employ, I think I've been fortunate. I think I've employed probably maybe 5,000 people since I started in business over the time. And obviously I don't know them all personally. I haven't interviewed a lot of them, but I think you get better with people as you get older and understand more who's wasting your time, who's going to be good, who's not. I tell you what as well, you know, when I had a gold business, so, you know, Cash for Gold, you guys called it, and it was one of the fastest growing companies in the UK in 2008, 2009. And that gave me a lot of my capital to start the Bushell Investment Group. But I remember my dad saying at the time, looking at the people coming in for jobs, and if they'd moved jobs, you know, under 5 years every time, he was like, they're not loyal. But of course, that was a different world. He was thinking about back to the 70s and 80s when he was employing people. You know, so I would say if they keep leaving jobs, that's a big red herring as well. And, you know, they've moved from 2 years, you know, two-year job. But I understand that happens a lot more nowadays. I'd still prefer people stayed longer because it takes so long to train people and to trust people and to grow with people. And I want to know that people have got my back and then I'll have their back and we can grow together. You know, most of my senior staff have been with me for over a decade.
Sure. My first employee still works here. My second employee still works here. My third employee still works here. A couple of things that I'll say. I remember earlier in my career, I especially hiring salespeople, I would fall into the same trap you did in terms of they sounded really good. They would talk about all their pelts on the wall. I wouldn't really verify it like I should. I kind of didn't take myself out of the thought that, well, this is a salesperson. They're actually like built to be in these meetings and talking and making me feel comfortable and confident and building a rapport with me. And so I made a lot of mistakes earlier on in my career, confidence or just acumen or what they kind of presented themselves as. And then they'd get into the actual company and you'd be like, oh man, I bought the wrong stock here. This was not the right person, not the right fit. So I really had to modify my sales interviews. I thought that was really important. And then going to the point about jumping, you know, the way I tell people this is that it's definitely something that should raise a question and you should ask about, right? If they have a lot of it, usually the problem's with the person and not the company. But there's been scenarios, particularly when you look at like the financial crisis or COVID, where good people had three jobs in 4 years for reasons that go beyond their own control, right? So to me, I look at it as an opportunity to dive in and find out what happened here. What's the story? And then if you have somebody that's victim blaming or they're, it was my manager here in this situation here, that for me is immediately like, okay, this is probably more a you thing than a them thing. But I will say there was some resumes I've seen where I thought the person, you know, wasn't loyal or was going to multiple jobs in a short time span. And then I would talk to them about what happened and it made a lot of sense. And sometimes those have been some of the best hires. So I think the key to everything is if you have a question about something, you should definitely raise an eyebrow, but dig in and find out, because sometimes you might find some of the best people are ones that have a great explanation to that. But other times, you know, you can get caught in that for sure.
I wholeheartedly agree.
Love it. Last question on the hiring side. Do you have a favorite question that you like to ask in either an interview setting or one of the boxers or any questions that like you think gives you a good distillation of who somebody is?
So I'm a firm believer in people should know what their faults are, not what they're good at. It's easy to know what you're good at. Yep. And I think it's really important. One of the biggest assets you can have is knowing what you're not good at. And people recognizing it. So it's conscious competence, conscious incompetence, and so on and so forth. And so I ask people what they're not good at, and I want to see their responses. So often, if they think they're brilliant and they've never thought about what they're not good at, they'll just give you like a stock answer, like, you know, oh, I'm not good in sales situations, or I'm not good. And you'll know if it's a disingenuous answer or not. Whereas I like people that have really thought about what they're not good at, because let's be honest, they wouldn't be in the room if you didn't think they were good for a specific role. So what we want to know is what they're not good at. And, you know, and I think that then tells you whether they're a genuine person or whether they've thought about it before. Because I think your best asset is knowing what you're bad at.
here's where we're going. I want to know what you're working on right now that you're excited about. Is there a specific business? Is there something going on in your life right now that just you get up in the morning and you're floating thinking about it?
So it's what we discussed earlier, the employment law, where we're doing this buy and build. So very simply, we're just under seven figures in that business of EBITDA. We add on three businesses of say 300 grand EBITDA. We take it to 2 million EBITDA. We can then sell for a 12 times multiple as opposed to at the moment where we'd be worth a 6 or 7 times multiple. It's really simple. It's a buy and build strategy of an old school retained customer's business. It's being done again and again and again in multiple sectors. And it's what I'm doing at the moment. It's what I'm excited about at the moment because I'm talking to all these business owners and I'm persuading them to do their best to sell a chunk of their business to me at a lower multiple, promising them that when they join us, they'll get a higher multiple on their smaller shareholding later on. And it's having those conversations with people because a lot of these people aren't ready to retire yet. So we have to take them on the journey. And it's as sexy as our unsexy business gets at the moment, I'm afraid. I'd love to tell you I've got an app that's going to change the world and it's going to change how people perceive this or perceive that, but that's not
your
me,
business. That's not your world. This is what excites you. Seeing an opportunity, figuring out how you can add your own touch to it and make something better and then take it to another level of value. I mean, that's a super respectable business. It's obviously very lucrative. And it's something that gets you up and gets you excited. And I'm the same way, man. I mean, I have, you know, when we're working with different customers and I see an issue that I know we've seen before and we can add value and we can make that better. And I know that customer is going to keep coming back to us and they're going to think that we changed the world for them. That's what gets me excited, man. I love making an impact and you're making an impact on these investors and on this business. So I love that. I think that's awesome. Lee, I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much for the time, brother. Appreciate you. Have a good one. Talk to you later.
Thank you very much, Pat.